You please pray with me, O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, beloved Jesus Christ, blessed Master, dearest Mother, saints and sages of all religions, I bow to all of you. Free my life from all obstacles, and give me physical, mental, and spiritual development. Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only king.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness. Wonderful to be here. Jerry asked me why I came to Vancouver, and just for you. It's lovely to be here. Special prayers tonight for Sarah and her little dog Sophie, who just left the body last evening. Very special little soul, Sophie. And Sarah, I don't know if you'd like to tell about the 13 orchids or...
This orchid for a long time, and it had big spikes of orchids, and the other day a few of them wilted, and so I trimmed them off, and then today I was thinking about flowers for her, and I just happened to count them because there were so many of them, that it was 13, and she was 13 years old, so I thought that was pretty special. And another orchid blossomed recently. It had a new spike. And one of the first flowers just fully opened today. So I picked that one too. And that one symbolizes her and me. And then there was a third orchid. A really special, delicate one. Unusual one. I got it, I don't know, maybe 12 years ago or... maybe even 13, who knows. And it's got a really pretty little white orchid, really delicate. So I picked that one for her too, because she was so tiny. So it was a good day to be with her. It was good. I just buried her before I came. My friends in their yard, by their dog that we buried a couple of years ago. So... we had a little casket made for her. I made the one for their dog a few years ago. But they didn't have children either. So it's really easy to think of them as children.
Mm-hmm.
They did with their dog and I did with her.
Yeah.
But that's why you have real kids, right? They last longer. I heard that one with comedy show. But anyway, yeah, it was.
Well, it's a special soul. There's many, many of these animals there that come. We call them pets. They're really companions in our life. And just our love and our prayers go out to you, and seeing Sophie just freed from a body that was no longer working well and happy and playing and full of life and joy.
I really think she's carrying some karma for me because she got sick when I got sick. And then I got better and she didn't. So.
Well, even as kindred spirits, we come together in groups, and it's not by accident. We're deeply connected one to another.
I just wish I'd get this non-attachment thing.
Well,
such a hard one.
Yeah. I think in the terms of when there's a passing of anyone whom we've loved and feel such strong feelings for, that there is that human element, that human side of it, where we feel that there is that passing, there is that leaving, and a sadness that goes with that. What balances that is the knowledge that that soul continues as well. And that in the same way that if somebody were to leave at a certain time, go to a distant part of the world, and we may not see them again in a lifetime, and yet if that individual were pursuing their dreams and going forward, we would feel happy for them. And at the same time, we would feel sad that we don't have our friend close to us in the way that we had before. So both are there, and rightfully so, rightfully. So the feeling of sadness, the feeling of grief is there, but it's leavened, it's balanced with that intuitive knowledge that the soul has moved forward and is pursuing her dreams. Maybe chasing butterflies in the astral. Poor butterflies. Yeah, right. Right. So to honor the grief, the feeling of loss and sadness, and at the same time to bring to mind the knowledge, the awareness that this soul has moved forward, and that really, in a blink of an eye, will follow suit at some point. And it can be years and years, but from the big time element, it's not long. One of the things that I've come to realize down through time, as God has showed me different incarnations, is how fleeting life is, number one, and how oftentimes we've made entrances and then exits. And it doesn't totally take away the sting of a death, but it helps, it truly does help to balance it, knowing that we've come many times, we leave many times. And wouldn't it be nice if we could make it a bit more graceful in the coming and the going? And as we progress and move into the higher and higher ages, those kinds of transitions become much easier. We don't feel so strongly that this is the end of anything. It's just simply a transition, moving from one room to another. And the more deeply we can know that and feel it, it comes like a healing balm. And as I say, there's still the human side that misses. It leaves a gap. It leaves a hole that's never completely filled by anyone or anything else, because that creation of God is unique. It can't be filled by anyone else. But we do move on, and we do find happiness. And so some grief is there, fine. Let it flow through. Let it move through. Where we get stuck oftentimes is we clench and we hold tight and we don't allow the grief to move through. Feeling like it's too much, it's overwhelming. Are we letting go of that soul or that personality in letting the grief go? Are we being disloyal? And the answer is no, of course. Sophie would not want you to be sad. Knowing that you're sad, she would be disturbed by that and distressed by that. And so it's not her wish for you to feel badly and to feel that grief moving through, moving through. And even in the pain of grief, there can be a tinge of sweetness. And certainly gradually the knowledge of having enjoyed and shared a life together, the feeling of gratitude feeling of love, that becomes more predominant than the feeling of sadness. But it takes time. It takes time. So attachment is when we don't allow it to move through. We don't allow that soul in our mind and our heart to move forward. And that's not beneficial to them, nor is it to us. So just to be mindful of that. But that you feel grief? Of course you do. Sadness? Of course. Of course. Thank you for coming tonight. I know it was a little bit of a struggle to do so, so I appreciate it. Reading from the Gospel of Ramakrishna, Ramakrishna speaking. Can one ever bring God under control through wealth? He can be turned only through love. What does he want? Certainly not wealth. He wants from his devotees love, devotion, feeling, discrimination, and renunciation. One looks on God exactly according to one's own inner feeling. Take, for instance, a devotee with an excess of tamas, or that is, heavy, more depressive kind of mood. He thinks that the Divine Mother eats goat, so he slaughters one for her. Again, the devotee endowed with rajas, or activating, cooks rice and various other dishes for the mother. But the sattvic devotee, the one who's filled with sweetness and light, doesn't make any outer show of his worship. People don't even know he is worshiping. If he has no flowers, he worships God with the mere Ganges water and the leaves of the bell tree. His food offering to the deity consists of sweetened puffed rice or a few candies. Occasionally, he cooks a little rice pudding for the deity. There is another class of devotees, those who are beyond the three gunas. They have the nature of a child. Their worship consists of chanting God's name, just his name. Speaking to Kashab with a smile, why is it that you are ill? There is a reason for it. Many spiritual feelings have passed through your body. Therefore, it has fallen ill. At the time an emotion is aroused, one understands very little about it. The blow that it delivers to the body is felt only after a long while. I have seen big steamers going by on the Ganges, at the time hardly noticing their passing. But oh my, what a terrific noise is heard after a while when the waves splash against the banks. Perhaps a piece of the bank breaks loose and falls into the water. An elephant entering a hut creates havoc within and ultimately shakes it down. The elephant of divine emotion enters the hut of this body and shatters it to pieces. Do you know what actually happens? When a house is on fire, at first a few things inside burn. Then comes the great commotion. Just so the fire of knowledge at first destroys some enemies of spiritual life as passion, anger, and so forth. Then comes the turn of the ego. And lastly, a violent commotion is seen in the physical frame. You may think everything is going to be over, but God will not release you as long as the slightest trace of your illness is left. You simply cannot leave the hospital if your name is registered there. As long as the illness is not perfectly cured, the doctor won't give you permit to go. Why did you register your name in the hospital at all? Everyone laughed. Kashab laughed again and again at the master's allusion to the hospital. It's an interesting thing when we start on the spiritual journey, because we do so, of course, with the idea that we want that eternal bliss and love and upliftment. We want the transformation that comes with it. But here, Ramakrishna is speaking of the hospital. Master used to describe the work that he did with disciples as running a spiritual hospital, and that people were in varying stages of recovery. And that is why some were able to live up to his teachings and others were not, because of their state of recovery. But that once you enter into these experiences, as God puts you through them, you are transformed, you are moved a little bit to the left. In the Bible, it talks about being moved to the little bit to the left, a few cubits, and then a little bit to the right by a few cubits. This Ramakrishna is talking about, it's like an elephant inside of a small hut. These tremendous spiritual feelings and experiences begin to come over you. And you feel that perhaps you can't take it, that it's too much, that it strains the heart and the entire nervous system too much. And you can even think, why in the world did I start this? Why did I register myself in the hospital at all? Maybe it would have been better just to live an ordinary life. This mother felt on many occasions as she is going through this mystical crucifixion. And yet she felt so clearly, so powerfully in herself, that this is something that she had come to do, even though nobody had ever told her about the details of what she was going through. And so it is through these experiences that this transformation comes. But when this heart center, for instance, opens, and you feel this Gordian knot, as it is called, within the heart center, and it begins to open up, what is it? What is the resistance in there? It is because we have loved in the past, and we have felt disappointed, we have felt hurt, we have felt injured in some way. And so we closed our heart down. And it's not easy to let it open back up again. And how much more so is it when it comes to divine love? The divine love that is in you and in all of us, it is innate. It has always been there, and somehow we sense it. We yearned to have that love, to be loved in the way that only really God can love us in the end. And so we stand at that precipice. And that happened for me many years ago as I was entering into this path. And Mother began it by speaking to me one night. We were all together. Something was new in the world at that time called deep dish pizza, of all things. And Mother and a group of about 20 of us went out to experience this deep dish pizza. And little did I know, sitting next to Mother, that it would be a monumental night for me. I had been in her presence at other times when she was speaking to somebody, and to all intents and purposes, I should have been able to hear everything that she said. But she is speaking just to that individual, and I couldn't make out a word, and I admit I tried to eavesdrop. And I tried to hear it, and I couldn't. Well, this night was my turn to have this kind of experiences, and she turned towards me, and I could feel this field of energy around the two of us that she just wrapped us around as like we were the only two in this entire restaurant. And she looked at me and she said, "Why don't you love me completely?" And I instantly knew what she was referring to, because my mind went to a previous relationship that I had had that was my first love in this world, and it hadn't worked out. And so I had felt such great pain, even though I had initiated the separation for 2 years. I just felt this tremendous pain, and it was part of a spiritual crisis that I was going through at the time. And so I told Mother a little bit about that, and she said, "If you do not love completely, you cannot have God realization." Well, that put it right in my face, and I had to deal with it. Before that, it was just easy to put it aside and sweep it under the rug. So for 2 weeks, I thought about this, and I thought about the pain that I went through and the potential for opening myself to that once again. And I wasn't at all sure whether I wanted to do that or not. And then finally, I came to the conclusion, what is this life worth? If I live an entire lifetime and not have my full realization of God. And so this was just not acceptable. And I'd made a decision that whatever the consequences, that I would open my heart. But I didn't know how. At the time, I felt like I really didn't love anyone or anything. And so it started me on a journey, and I thought, well, here are two great saints that I know about who are such great lovers of God. One of them is the same Ramakrishna. The other was Saint Francis, one east, one west. And I can't say that I set out and planned it out in a logical kind of way. It's just I was drawn to books about these two great saints and started reading about them. And it really changed me. I remember I was reading the book about Saint Francis by Nikos Kazantzakis. It's a tremendous novel about Saint Francis' life. And I was so absorbed in this that I was going to university at the time, and I had a couple of roommates. And I must have been in quite a distracted mood because we were all sitting around the table eating. And then suddenly they both started laughing at me. And I don't know, maybe somebody had said something, and I was in such a distracted mood that I didn't hear them, and I saw them laughing. And I was in a very strange state, and I just got up from the table, and I went back to start reading again. And I was completely immersed into this story. And so as the time unfolded, I used to go back up on top of this hill and called Seaholm Hill in Bellingham, where the university was at, and I had a special rock that I sat on. It. I had felt something special about this area. You do that sometimes. You're in nature, you're someplace, and suddenly you just get a really special feeling about where you're at, like there's a tremendous power, an uplifting power that's there. And I had this about this rock that was well off the beaten path. And as far as I know, no one else ever ventured there. But from that rock, I could look out on the city. And as my wont was at the time, I would go there at nighttime, look out over the city lights, and I would meditate upon God there. And one night, I had a terrific vision. And in that vision, Jesus came to me, and he said a strange thing. He said, "I am the groom, you are the bride." Now, metaphysically, I knew what that meant, because this ajna here is the Christ center, and it is the masculine aspect of spirit. And at the base of the spine is the shakti, is the soul. And that is feminine in nature. And the feminine rises up in order to be united with the male. So the female and the male get united right within your own spinal system. And so oftentimes we're looking for that special someone on the outside. But really, inside, what we're really looking for is that spiritual union. And this terrific kundalini force had already erupted and started streaming up from the base of my spine to the ajna here. And so when he said, "I am the groom and you are the bride," he was denoting that he was that omniscient spirit and I was the individualized soul, and that we should become as one, as the bride and the bridegroom. And so this was a tremendous experience that I had in this vision in which I saw Jesus. And it was to presage something, because the very next night I was up there and meditating at the same point, and I had been experiencing for some time such a tremendous pain in my heart center. It just felt like my heart was going to crack in two. And it was just so, so painful. I didn't think I could really stand it. And that night, it just erupted into even more pain than what I had before. And I was just down. I just couldn't even sit up. And suddenly, something snapped. Something cracked. And it was this Gordian knot that came loose. And suddenly, this divine love started flowing through me. It came from behind me and through this heart and then just flooded out into this world. It was like something I had never experienced before. And as I said even before, just before this, I couldn't say that I loved anyone or anything. But this love just started streaming out of my heart. And then the whole world became immersed like an ocean of love. And the air itself was saturated with this love. I wish that I could explain it more fully because it's so tremendous, so powerful, so transforming to go through. And I was swimming in this sea of love. In fact, I just fell down onto the ground. And if someone had been around, I'm sure they would have locked me up because I was swimming in the dirt because I just felt it all saturated with this love. And then I was stroking the branches and the trees, and everything was vibrant with this tremendous spiritual power. And it stayed, and it stayed, and it stayed. What I had been yearning for so long was now being manifest. I didn't even know what it was that I was looking for. And yet, here it was. And it was surprising because it was so tactile, it had such a feeling for it, such power to it, that it was convincing down to my very core. There's no way that I could have made this up or that I could have even tried to imagine it. It was a full experience. It was in every cell of my being. In fact, my cells of my being just spread out all over this creation. And so it's unlike anything that anyone could ever experience in the human sense. It's only when we go through this in the divine sense. And so I know exactly when Ramakrishna talks about the elephant moving a little to the left and a little to the right and can just tear down the entire body. Because, as Jesus said, you don't pour new wine into an old wineskin. That you get a new wineskin. Well, the wineskin is this body. The wine is the bliss of God. And he said if you were to pour the wine into an old wineskin, it would very well split open. It couldn't contain it. And so we go through this entire transformation, in transformation of body, mind, and soul. When Master was with Ram Gopal of Mazandar and was asking him for God realization, and that Ram Gopal said, if I were to give it now to you, it would burn every cell of your body right on out. You couldn't take it. You're not prepared for it. But soon, your guru, your master, will give you this experience. But right now, you're not ready for it. So even though we think we're ready for it, even though we think that we yearn for it and want it, it's nothing to be afraid of. Because God will deem when the right moment is. He will prepare you. He will take you through all the experiences that are necessary. And sometimes they're tough. They're really tough. They're painful. They're difficult situations in our life. But they're all geared for one purpose only, and that is to bring us into that kingdom of light, to bring us into the kingdom of heaven. We have to be willing to pick up our cross and to follow Jesus, to follow the Christ. It's the universal Christ. We have to be able to do that if we're to enter into this highest and rare state of full realization of God. I can tell you, because it's the truth of my own experience, it is possible to attain to this state of consciousness. It's not just reserved for a few. In fact, it is our inheritance, it is our privilege, it is our right. And you say, well, if it is our inheritance, why isn't it something that's just handed to us then? I would like that, I would like to have that experience. Why don't you just give it to me? And the reason is, as said earlier, you have to be prepared for it. It's true, it is your inheritance. But you've been the prodigal son, you've been the prodigal daughter. You've wandered away from God. You've wandered away from realization. As a result of that, you're not prepared at this time. You have to go through the preparation. First, the kundalini within you has to be erupted. Now, how does that happen? Well, it happens through the grace of God, and actually, we need to be prepared for that to happen. How do we prepare ourselves? We do it by meditating, by divinely loving God, by serving Him, by keeping our mind on Him at all times and all places. Through that, the intensity of that devotion begins to build in us. And then, at some point, our whole attention gets riveted right at the ajna, the point between the eyebrows. And it becomes something that is beyond ourselves because an inner power has been awakened inside of us that's beyond our own individuality. And we get positively riveted here at the ajna. And then suddenly that life energy is drawn, it is released like a giant rocket that takes off, an explosion of light that comes rushing up the spine. And when it first happened to me, it was as if there's such tremendous heat there in my forehead, and perhaps an odd thought, but I thought, you could fry eggs on my forehead, so hot there. And the intensity of it, the great feeling of pressure and pain was there, but also of bliss. And I was so interested in it because nothing like that had occurred for me up until that point. And suddenly I felt this. And I had Mother's teachings. I had been with her for some time before that. And so I knew what it was that was happening to me. And it was wonderful. And I thought, this is what she's describing. And yet there's no real words that can convey it to anyone. It's a difficulty with all spiritual experiences. Because we can use the words, but unless you have common ground around the experiences, you can't really know the fullness of everything that's being described. It's only when you go through those experiences, it's when you get uplifted, and then it acts as confirmation. But I tell you these things so that it helps to prepare the soil, it helps prepare the field of your own mind and your own consciousness, so that you can see yourself entering into that kind of an experience. Now, everybody's individual experiences are tailored exactly for them, so no two people will ever go through identical set of experiences. But there are certain hallmarks that happen along the way. And as a result of that, you can listen to the teachings both as a way of preparing you for what is to come. But also, when these things happen, then it acts as confirmation for what it is that you have experienced as it comes along. And so it helps to tell you whether you are on the right track or not. But when this experience comes, it begins to change you. It transforms you. And in one way, it happens too slowly. You want it to happen faster. In another way, it almost seems too powerful and too much. And that is because ego is essentially contractive. It wants to define things in order to stay in control around them. Spirit is essentially expansive. And these two things create the battlefield. One force is opposing and wants to keep you from going to God. The other force is taking you towards God. And back and forth you go. Now, the more pure we can be in our devotion to God and to keep our mind in perfect faith fixed upon Him, feeling that tremendous love and desire in order to attain God realization, it's all there. It's all there. The grace is there. The power of transformation is there as long as you keep your mind fixed on Him. But what happens in the meantime is that this oppositional force presents every God-blessed thing and non-blessed thing that you can think of to throw at you to see whether it will not dissuade you. So desire nature, fear, you name it, everything comes at you. Now, what is it that we see in Papa, in Master, in Mother? We see such determination, such clarity of purpose, such a desire to go all the way to God realization. And this is what is required. Now, in the beginning, we may not have that purity of purpose. We're more mixed. A part of us wants it. We want to have that experience, but we want to keep ourselves in control as well. We don't want things getting out of hand. We don't want to be embarrassed. We don't want to be taken someplace that is too difficult. Now, God, being in charge of the whole show, will see to it that no matter what we're taken through, no matter what is asked of us to do, it'll all, the means will be there for us to be able to fulfill that divine will. God would not put us in a situation that we were not able to do. But what happens is that people get distracted. They suddenly, their vision goes to the left, it goes to the right, it gets pulled off in a certain direction. And now there's the trouble. Because when that desire nature takes over, or when that fear takes over, it can take us a long ways out of the way. Sometimes people have initial experiences in God, and they begin to get lifted up, and it scares them. And as a result of being scared, they turn it off. We can do that. That may sound astounding to you, that once these experiences start, that you could tell them to go away. But if we do so firmly and loudly enough, they will. They'll stop occurring. And sometimes people do that because they feel like they're not ready for it. But if they were not ready for it truly, it would not begin in the first place. And so they turn it off, and as a result of that, they turn away from God. And they can still ostensibly be on the spiritual path, but they're not making any real progress. It's like the man who, in the story, he looked through all the three worlds for God, for the doorway to God. And he looked and looked and looked, and he traveled and he traveled and he traveled until finally he came to that place that he knew with all of his mind, all of his heart, this was the doorway to God. And there were seven steps going up to this doorway, and as he took one step after another, he started to think about it. He thought, well, what will happen when I go through this door? I don't know what will happen. What will happen to me? And maybe I won't exist anymore. Or maybe God will be angry with me and send me away. Maybe it'll be devastating. I don't know. And suddenly he thought the better of it. And he thought, well, I just don't want to disturb God right now. And so he tiptoed away down the rest of those steps, and he knew that he could go anywhere in the three worlds except for that one place. And as a result of that, he wandered and wandered and wandered. But you know, as Elizabeth Icke said, eternity is long enough. Nobody can hold out for an eternity. Nobody wants to. Eventually, we try out all of the things in this world. We try out every relationship, every lifestyle, everything. Until we come to realize there are many good and beautiful and wonderful lives we can lead in this world. But none of them fulfills all of the heart's desires. Only one thing can do that, and it's designed to be so. And so we go throughout all these three worlds, wandering and wanting to find real happiness, lasting happiness. But nothing will ever fulfill that. And we're constantly reminded. We're constantly reminded something that we love and treasure is taken away. And we think, well, I just had it, and now it's gone. And so somebody loses wealth, another loses a loved one, other things leave that individual. And gradually we come to that wisdom. There is no ultimate happiness in this world. I will never find it. I will never find it. And even when I sporadically find it, it's always taken away. And so there's only one place that we find that absolute and total fulfillment, that love, that joy, that bliss, that light, that wisdom. And that is in reuniting our soul with the soul of God to reunite that bride and that bridegroom and to merge them into one. Now, human marriage reflects our divine marriage, and it prepares us, really, because we learn in marriage, we learn to compromise, we learn to hang in there even when things are tough. We learn to look past the little foibles and see the greater heart of God beating within the other individual. And yet it's not always easy, but we do it. And by doing that, we help prepare ourselves for the grand marriage with the divine, because in that, we have to look past the things that seem to disturb and bother us. The big questions that we have for God, why did such and such happen? And why did such and such happen? And they seem to be so important at the time. But you know what my own experience is that when we enter into that state of oneness, all of those questions just seem to melt away. It's as if they have no real meaning to them anymore. They're inconsequential. What had before been such a big deal is now transformed into nothing at all. Because now you stand in that divine presence. And all questions, all of your heart's desires are fulfilled in that. It's a tremendous thing. It's a tremendous thing. And when we turn our minds towards God, we can have that. It's not far away. It's not distant. You wouldn't be here if it were. And yet we cannot hold anything back for ourselves. It doesn't mean that we don't live life. We do. We go out into the world. We serve in this world. We do many of the things that we've always done. But inwardly, we're always attuning ourselves to the divine mind, to the divine consciousness. And then through life, we forget that for a while. We forget God for a while. And we wander away from Him, but then we get reminded because it becomes painful after a while, it becomes lonely. And we're missing our divine friend. We're missing that connection that we have once felt. And so then we make our way back towards God. Mother described herself as a fisherman. And she would hook a disciple, and she'd start to reel them into the boat. But, as big fish oftentimes do, sometimes they take off on you. And all you can do is let the line run. And it goes and it goes and it's going all the way down to the bottom of the ocean once again. And then at some point it turns and it starts to come back and you start reeling it in patiently. With persistence, your attention has never left the disciple. And you're reeling and you're reeling and they come so far and then suddenly they bolt again. And you have no choice. You just let the line run. But each time they run a little bit less. They don't go quite as deep before they turn and they come back. And finally, when you've had a really big one, you struggle it all the way into the boat and there's such a feeling of satisfaction because that one, that tremendous soul, has finally gotten their full realization. Ramakrishna was one. He identified one soul. There are several who came that he identified as his. And one of them's names was Narendra. And Narendra went through many stages. He was a young man when he came, first came. He was 17, 18 years old. And he went through an atheistic stage when he was with Ramakrishna. He didn't believe in God. He didn't believe in any of these kinds of things. And the disciples would come because Vivekananda, he later on became Swami Vivekananda. And he would say, I don't believe in any of this. And he would say so to anyone. He was never one who cared what anybody else thought. And so he would say it to everyone. And the disciples would come to Ramakrishna and report to him what Narendra was saying. And Ramakrishna would say, never mind, he's one of mine. He will come. And gradually, you see, he could let him run and go out. And then he would start reeling him back in again. And he was a big one. He was a big one because he is a tremendous soul in God, a tremendous soul in God. And really, he was a forerunner for Yogananda. He was helping to prepare the ground so that when Yogananda came, he could really make a transformation in this world and change this Western world. And the Autobiography of a Yogi has been a bestseller for so many years. And from the time when Mother first met Yogananda, and she had never heard of the words yoga before, she had never heard of the word guru before, she had never heard of the word karma before, and she wasn't alone. These were not part of the common vernacular of the time. And yet, think today, we have Wall Street gurus. You ask what karma is, practically anybody on the street could tell you at least a loose definition of what karma is. So this is a tremendous transformation that has gone on. And it's a blending, it's a merging of East and West. Now, the East has this science of yoga, the science of Kriya, the science of meditation, of how to go inward. Christianity has love for God, but it doesn't really teach the means for going inside and finding God there. That really needed to come from the East. That's where that knowledge was preserved. And the tremendous technological revolution and all the advances in science, that travels back to India and all around this world. And so there's an exchange of wisdom. There's an exchange of benefits of both lifestyles. And so we can benefit from the technology. We can benefit from the science. But it's not everything. Because science will never give us that lasting happiness. It'll never give us the treasure of God realization. Because it's focused on the things of this material world. And while it is true, this material world is made up of God stuff, it is not the means for finding God. That happens within. When I was talking to Mother one time, I was telling her that how tremendously I felt God inside of me. But that when I got around groups of people, I didn't feel God. And it was disturbing to me. It was difficult for me to be around a lot of people and noise and laughter and so on. And she said, first, you find God within you. And then you begin to find him everywhere about you. First, you find God within. Now, sometimes, perhaps we're out in nature someplace. We're up on a mountaintop. We're next to a seashore. And our spirits expand. We feel the vibrancy of pure nature all around us. And we are lifted up and we get a glimpse into the heavenly kingdom. And so in that sense, we can find it in nature at times. But to really find it consistently and permanently requires us to go within ourselves, because we have to plumb the depths of our own consciousness, which means we have to go through all those states of mind that we have generated down through many lifetimes. So this is really quite a journey. It's quite a journey. And when that elephant begins to move a few cubits this way and a few cubits that way, you really wonder. You really wonder. But it's all necessary in order for all of your consciousness to be stripped down to the bone, so that you're stripped down to the bone. You're completely emptied. Emptied out totally. And then you are rebuilt from the inside out, so that that new wine can be poured into you and it won't burst the skin. You'll be able to expand with it and enter into that fathomless bliss and light and expansion of consciousness. This is what we are here for. And we balance it in our lives with all the other things that we do. But we don't lose God. We make God first. We put God first. And learn to find God in everyday events. Don't make God just something for your meditation blanket, although he is definitely to be found there. But when you enter into this world, find God there. You are in service to him in all that you do. So we don't want to put God out there someplace or up on a pedestal and then something not connected with our own lives as we actually live it. But rather, when you move out into this world, just think, all right, I'm serving God in this way now. And all of these people that I'm meeting, they're individualities of God who are coming to me, and they're perfectly designed for me. I can find fault with them. I can think of all the ways they disturb me. Or I can see them as God come to me. This is my challenge, is to see through the mask and see the inward divinity. Now, that doesn't mean that all the character patterns of another person is going to make you think of God. Some people have unlovely personalities. They just simply do. Usually, if we could go far enough, if we cared enough, we could go far enough within that individual psyche and see that they are in great pain. One of the things you can tell yourself when you meet somebody with unlovely characteristics, a happy person, a well-adjusted person, doesn't act like this. They don't treat other people this way. And yet, God has put this person in my life. Why? So that I can not get distracted from keeping my mind on God, so that the play doesn't become more important than the playwright. And God is the author of all of this that exists. And when I keep my mind on him and not get distracted with personalities and situations, I find the key to that everlasting happiness and bliss. So this is a tremendous adventure that we've begun. A tremendous adventure. I can't think of anything that is more challenging, that requires more from us on every single level, physically, mentally, and spiritually. And as a result, it has the greatest results. It has the greatest prize at the end. And that is your communion and your oneness with the infinite Spirit, from which we have all evolved and to which we all return. So I'm very, very happy that we come together in satsang. Sat means truth, means one spirit. Sang means connection, collection, that we all come together around the one truth, the one eternal state of being. And so it's a wonderful time that we come together like this. As I've been speaking to you, I feel so uplifted. A part of me is aware of this room, very small part. The rest is out in a vast, infinite sea of light. And I see each and every one of you exactly the same. That you have a human expression. But the greater part of you is expanded out into a vast sea of light. And whether you are conscious of it or not is just what stage of recovery are you in? You're in the spiritual hospital. And so when you allow yourself to recover, and you set yourself upon a recovery program, then you discover that vast, infinite potential. Jesus said it this way, that it begins with the size of a mustard seed. Tiny, tiny little seed. You've seen mustard seeds before. And it grows into a great, vast tree. Isn't that amazing? Isn't that amazing? Out of that one tiny little seed, an enormous tree is the result. And that seed of God realization starts out inside of you. And sometimes it seems so weak and so small, so fragile. And yet, with the least bit of watering, with care, by our attention and our devotion, it grows into a vast tree of realization. So husband your trees to the point where they begin to provide shade for you. And the birds of heaven, those divinely inspired thoughts, come to nest in that tree. In our prayer, we say, I am he. I am that. The I am, the great I am. Please pray with me. O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, I feel the wonder and the beauty of Thy glorious presence in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for Thee. I kneel in adoration at Thy feet and surrender myself to Thee. I feel the power of Thy perfection surging in every cell of my body. My mind and my intelligence are radiant with Thy healing light. My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss of my communion with Thee. I and my Father are one. Blessed Spirit, I am He. That light, that joy, and that love ever blossom within your hearts and spread its fragrance throughout this world to help it in its healing, upliftment, and enlightenment. Om Shri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram. Victory to God, victory to the light. A cute story that Sri Krishna, the Ram Nam that we are singing with him tonight, he came to me one day and he says, you're going to hear something brand new tonight that's never sang this before. And it was that version of Ram Nam. He says, it's the best version of Ram Nam. And he's so excited. It's just coming apart at the seams. He is so thrilled about this. Lovely, lovely soul living at the ashram. He is Papa Ram Das's nephew, grandnephew, so he's just a lovely soul.